Welcome to Hearing Voices from NPR. I'm Larry Massett. Our show today, Lost Critters. Have you ever lost a pet, dog, cat, a duck, guinea pig? You know what it's like. You run around the neighborhood searching frantically behind bushes, behind rocks, through alleys and vacant lots. You call everyone you know. You post signs on phone poles. And every time you see a shadow or hear a rustle in the leaves, you think, there it is, there it is, and your blood pressure shoots the moon. Basically, you're having a nervous breakdown. Now, think how you'd feel if you'd lost not just one animal, but hundreds of thousands of them.
Some people don't like camels. They bite, they kick, they stink, they talk dirty. And above all, there are too many of them. In Australia, anyway, there are hundreds of thousands of feral camels roaming the outback, shiftless descendants of the hard-working dromedaries brought over in the 19th century before the roads and rails came in. When their services were no longer required, they were let go. Turns out, who knew? Camels thrive in the desert. While not as aggravating as rabbits or cane toads or the other run-amok imported species, still, what to do with them? Race them, of course, race them, why not? This is the annual Camel Cup race in Alice Springs in the Northern Territory. A dozen camels are galumphing around the track as the crowd eggs them on. It's not dead serious. Most of these animals are just the local tourism camels. They know how to walk gentle and not bite children or kick retired schoolteachers. Getting them to line up for the start of a race is another matter. They don't like it one bit. And then, when they do take off, some go straight, some go sideways, some go backwards, riders fall off and what the heck. This is good family fun. Good with beer, too.
This one's Baby. Hello. He was found in the streets of Sydney, upside down at sunrise in the gutter. So he had to be rescued. And this one is a bit of a wine lush. See, he's drunk too much wine. That's Lush. And this one's Sister. It's a black doll, a knitted doll. And they're nearly contraband for a moment there because they were black. I'm not allowed to say that people are black. I don't know why. They were nearly made illegal. They were banned for a very long time, and now they're back. And these are original gollies. These have been saved from the olden times.
The trouble with using camels for fun is you don't use very many. A trained, tourist-friendly camel will be kept for many years. No turnover there. You're going to want something more drastic, more camel-consuming.
There used to be a really, really old story, like, I like pancakes. Do you know that story? I like pancakes, I like pancakes. It's a really, really old story, and it's about a black golly. It's called Golly, and he runs around a tree. The tiger chases him, and then they melt into pancakes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, the camels. Maybe you could eat them. At the slaughterhouse he runs a little north of Alice Springs, Gary Dan is watching camels come down the disassembly line. First they're stunned, then beheaded, bled, skinned, eviscerated, and thoroughly taken apart. Even the hump, which is not full of water, as often imagined.
It's beautiful white soft fat on the camel. We're trying to see if we can get into the Indonesia and the Philippines, which is very close here. Yeah, you can see it's lovely white fat, and it'd be for cooking their rice and be for the moisture. At the moment, we just throw it out.
This is grisly work, but you can get used to it. When it's time for lunch, Gary snags a couple very, very fresh steaks, and strolls out to the grill.
So we'll just put a little bit of salt on that one. Just a little bit of pepper. And we'll whack him on the barbecue.
Tastes just like beef, he says. Low fat, low cholesterol, excellent. Gary likes camel a lot. Yet he can sell only about 20 a week. Most Australians won't touch this stuff.
The future of the camel in Australia is beginning to look a little iffy.
My name is Sam Watkins. We're at Tijikala, which is 120 approximately kilometres south of Alice Springs on the Old South Road. I've got six camels here, six camels that I caught from a friend's cattle property. Trying to break them in gently, trying to incorporate as much free will as I can into my training process here. Really very basic. I just want them to follow a rope, to be led, and I want them to sit down, and I want them to wear a saddle and carry a load and walk in a string, walk in a train. And beyond that, they can do whatever they like.
Sam likes camels. He feels he understands them.
I really strongly believe that there's a lot to be understood in these animals about how to think and how to live. Their ability to reconcile what has happened to them in this period of captivity is incredible. If I had been captured, castrated, and was now held in a pen, I'd be sitting in the corner rocking, or I'd be gnashing my teeth. I don't think I would be taking food relatively contentedly from my captors. So in that, there's something to understand.
His plan, once the camels are trained, is to work with local Aboriginal people to set up a trekking business. He actually has a government grant to do this. It's an employment program.
It doesn't come from some sort of evangelical missionary sort of feeling in myself. It's something which is in many parts selfish. It's what I want to do. It's what I've grown up doing, and it's a big part of my life. So in a long view, what I want to do is walk the traditional journeys that Aboriginal people in the past used to take. And it's a very obscure, marginal activity. But I think it's one that if I continue to pursue, I'll realise some of my vision.
The vision, Sam Watkins' vision, is not about the future. Good thing, because trekking the outback with a handful of camels won't affect the big picture at all. However, according to Sam, a few weeks walking in the wild will put you in touch with the past. Your past, our past as human beings. That time way back when we all used to go around with animals in paradise.
The main thing is some sort of almost religious reverence for this planet and the countryside. If you do get the opportunity to go and spend extended periods in an environment which doesn't reflect the one that you know best, you'll have access to what it is to be human. There's a big, big, big long past in us. Say 15,000 years ago, we were all part of a subsistence culture and we had very different relationship to the environment. And I think that that's something which is fundamental and part of us all. It's very good fun. That's the other side of it. Walking with camels in the desert is just fun, 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 as far as I can see anyway.
Camels was produced by myself, Larry Massett, with Jake Warga. The camels of Australia may be running out of luck, but if you're a lost critter near Los Angeles, California, there is a chance. A chance you'll run into the man producer Jay Allison met some years ago when he was doing a series of animal stories
This animal story is about Leo Grillo, who started an organization he calls Delta, Dedication and Everlasting Love to Animals. Leo goes into the mountains outside Los Angeles and collects abandoned dogs. They run wild in packs out there and gather at the picnic areas. Leo goes out and feeds, medicates, and befriends them, and then brings them back in to his place.
Hey, kids.
He started doing this with just a few dogs at a time.
Okay, okay.
When I visited him, he had over 300 in his shelter. He's also started picking up stray cats from construction sites. He's got dozens of those, including the cats with leukemia he intends to keep until they die. People can adopt Leo's animals as pets if they want, but it isn't easy. He puts every prospective owner through tests to make sure they love animals. Love them the way he does, like children. 4 out of 5 would-be owners are turned away. Leo tells the ones he turns away that they can go to the pound if they want and get an animal with no trouble. Go do it, he says. Millions are being killed each year. Get one with an X on its cage, because those are the ones that will be killed that day. But these animals are his. He thinks they've suffered enough in their lives, and he'd rather keep them than give them to someone who won't love them the way he does. Also, if you want a dog from Leo Grillo, you can't pick it out yourself. You can't even specify the breed or go look at the dogs ahead of time. Instead, Leo talks to you and then matches you up with one of his animals. He goes back to where the dogs are and brings one out for you. You take what he gives you. Some of the dogs and cats Leo keeps for himself. The hardest cases. The most abused. The sickest. Animals in trouble are Leo Grillo's purpose in life.
I guess I can't stand the suffering of an animal. You know, an animal looks up at you, and to me, I can feel what he's feeling as a human little thing. Or there's something going on. I don't just see a furry thing. I see the eyes, and I get right into the feelings of the animal. And something affects me, and I have to do something about it. I don't have that empathy maybe with people, or maybe I don't allow it, you know, to have that with people, because somehow people can take care of themselves. These guys can't. These animals can't. So I see that, and I have to do something about it. But I won't draw the line. See, I can't go to the pound. I have meetings with the director, the whole setup out here. I can't go to the pound. He has to meet me in a coffee shop, because if I go to the pound, I'm going to walk through, look at every animal, take every dog that's ready to be killed that day, and bring him to the shelter. I can't do that. But I will, you know. So for me, I know the weakness. The weakness is don't communicate. Don't be there. Just be removed. I can't go over the next hill if I don't have the room. Still, there's just this thing inside of me that pulls me, and I go into the next hill, and I find things all the time. I always find somebody when I do that. And this is my code, and this is the way I live. My one message to animals is, if you're hungry or if you're hurt, cross my path. That's my message. And since the day I said that, I was in Hollywood, I told you, and I'm walking down the street and cats are jumping out in front of me. Ever since then. I mean, my friends, nobody has this problem. I go down the street and they pop out of everywhere. And they're limping or they're hungry or whatever. And that makes me feel okay that I don't have to worry about, did I miss one? Because I said, no, he's okay. Because he didn't cross my path. And it is the same way, it's the same thing when you have one that's very sick, making the same decision. You tell me, what am I supposed to do? You know? I don't want you to suffer, but if you can make it, you know, and do you want to make it, and all these other things being considered, and still, even then, it has to be suffering with absolutely no prognosis. I'm not going to kill an animal that might, you know, die. I'm going to kill an animal and be with him during it only if there is no way, it's just totally impossible, and he's given up. And he understands, and he says the famous, I'm tired. If he says I'm tired, then I go, that's it. Let's do it. So, I have a dog at home that I got in, had distemper. Ended up, this dog lost the use of its rear legs. The vets said, put her down. No way. She lost the front legs. Now I'm carrying her in and out 5 times, 6 times a day. At night, I'm waking up twice to flip her over because she can't move. She had a heating pad on. She couldn't regulate her heat. Everybody except my wife that heard about it, you know, said, it's insane. I stopped, you know, we just stopped letting people know. The vet said, how'd that dog do? I said, oh, we put her down. I didn't tell him. 6 weeks I did this back and forth because she wanted to make it. There was just something about her. One day, well, I'm bouncing her up and down on her feet so she can get muscle tone. I'm bouncing her, and she's just limp. And all of a sudden, a foot goes out to get her balance. And it was the best thing that Bailey put a foot out. 2 weeks later, she could walk. Now she's running, tearing up. We've had her a year and a half now of tearing up everything. I mean, she's just... She always remembers, you know, that she was appealing to live, and she just needed somebody to give her the chance. I give them everything I can if they want to make it. If they want to live, there's something about it, they fight. I fight with them. I have a cat at home now that was here. He was a feral cat. He had leukemia. He got cancer. He got lymphosarcoma. He has tumors, and he's building up with fluid. Well, we worked on him, and I have him at home. I've tamed him down in a month. He's in my room right now, my bedroom. And we did a special new surgery. We put a tube inside him. And twice a day, I use that tube to pull fluid out of him. And then, of course, I put fluid back in properly and try to keep his body balanced. We do this every day. He's in no pain, and he purrs constantly. He just purrs and purrs and purrs, and he eats, and he wants you to play with him, and he's always rubbing his head up against you. This cat just has so much to offer. And the most important thing is to make him well. And even then, it's only for a few months. I mean, you know he's going to get it eventually. You know, it's a shame. It occurred to me that, you know, I have 10 cats at home. And they're running up to me one at a time. And they're all very healthy. And, you know, you pick them up and you know they're going to be around a long time. So there's this wonderful feeling. But at the same time, you know, I got to get in the room and take care of this guy that's real sick. And I said, it's amazing. But we only really pay that kind of attention and that kind of devotion to them when they're in that kind of trouble. You know? That could be it. My wife has another answer. She says when they're that close to death, they become perfect. And that's the attraction. I don't know. They're becoming, like, they know more. All of a sudden, they know. They know what's going on. They know here and beyond, and they know what the hell we're doing caught up in the middle of the two. You know? And they know something. And whatever it is, it changes them. You know, and they become worth more, if that's possible. I mean, they be, you know, I don't know. Just give them, you know, give them every shot. And let me see what's going on out there.
Cross My Path was produced by Jay Allison with Christina Egloff in 1988 for their series Animals and Other Stories, funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. Leo Grillo's organization, DELTA Rescue, is today the world's largest animal rescue shelter. Next up, the true story of one very lucky Sus Domestica. That's Latin for pig. We're looking for a pig. A lost pig.
Pig, 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 pig.
We're in a little patch of woods just across the Washington, D.C. city line. There's a waterfall here and a creek leading to the Potomac River, but it's not wilderness. There are houses all over. We can't see them because of the trees, but basically this is a suburb. We're a hop, skip, and a jump from the Washington Monument to the White House, National Airport, the Pentagon. How could anyone lose a pig here? And why? Ultimately, you might blame the United States Air Force. The guy behind the pig, whom I will call Sean, isn't in the Air Force itself, but his buddy Thomas is. They're both about 22, 23 years old, and a month ago, the Air Force decided to ship Thomas overseas. So the guys decided to throw a farewell barbecue, a real blowout. So Sean put an ad on Craigslist.
For either a pig or a goat, something for roasting for Thomas's going away thing. And this guy responded and then went out. We meet him in the back of his truck stop and he has a pig in a crate. And then it's bigger than we thought it was going to be and it's like more piggish looking than we thought it was going to be. It was 100 pounds. So it was like not the biggest pig, but it was not a small pig. So the guy just like pulls it out and like just lays down on it. And I have to hold its like face down, and then I'm just really scared because it keeps moving and twitching and stuff. And I was never more freaked out than that day. The entire trip, I was just so freaked out. And it's squealing, and it's the loudest thing I've ever heard in my life. It sounds like a jet engine. and he's this hog. He like hog ties it. No, just like, but louder, and just continuous. And we just put it in the car. We tied it so its butt was facing towards the front, so it couldn't nip our ears or anything. His ass was like this far from our head. It's really kind of smooth until we get to like 30 miles outside of DC, and then I'm just driving, and then it's kind of like Jurassic Park, because the all I see in my rearview mirror is the pig just go like, and then it just gets up, and then it starts like knocking around, and I'm really freaked out, and then it starts like turning around. We're like, okay, whatever, it can't, you know, those are knots, it can't get out. And then we see that its front legs have come untied. So I have a knife in my car, so I give it to my friend. I'm like, if that pig crosses this line, if he crosses this line, you have to just like stab him, because if he jumps in the front, everyone's gonna die. Yeah, I was just screaming and freaking out. But all I wanted to do is just get its head out the window, get some fresh air.
All it wanted was some air. So by the time they got back to town, the pig was no longer a monster. It was a friendly, intelligent creature. It had even picked up a name, Piggles. When it got dark, they drove Piggles here to the woods and tied him to a tree.
People kind of slowly trickled in with beer and Chipotle and liquor and stuff like that. And then we just started a fire and then had the pig here. And then I tried to make it very clear that I wanted the pig to be respected and not to, like, no one to, like, play with the pig or give the pig alcohol or, you know,
but
anything
you
like that.
Eat the pig that night?
Yeah, but I thought we could at least, like, respect him. Because the whole point of this was to, not to, like, slaughter the pig and just, like, you know, like, revel in its, like, bloodletting and whatever, but I wanted to, like, learn where pig, like, where meat comes from, where, like, you know, be closer to my food. So I wanted the pig to, like, have, you know, like, just have a nice last night, pretty much. Because the whole thing I kept saying was that, like, every pig dies, but not every pig truly lives.
We need to take a break here. Hearing Voices will be back in just a minute with the conclusion of Piggle's greatest adventure.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is back with Lost Critters. We've been following the story of Piggles the Pig, last seen tied to a tree somewhere in the woods. As the evening wore on, things began to get a little out of hand.
People started giving the pig alcohol and whiskey and stuff like that. I think the pig got pretty drunk. Thomas said he was, like, teetering over and, like, you know, like, just pretty drunk.
Sean admits his knowledge of butchering was based entirely on watching a YouTube video, but he did have the tools of the trade.
An axe, some large kitchen knives, and a blowtorch. The pig, he knew it was up. Like, I tried to hide the axe, the knives were in a bag, but he, as soon as he saw us, he just tried to run as far as he could, and, you know, of course he was tied to a rope. Hopefully I was going to try to, like, have someone distract it and just come up and just try to split its head open or stun it. And then we could just cut it open and get all the stuff out. And everyone was totally, you know, gung-ho, except for Thomas and his lady friend, who just kind of thought it wasn't a good idea. And then he's just like, ah, yeah, I don't know about this. And the girl didn't want to do it. And then slowly the votes turned to against killing the pig. We just untied it, and then, you know, it didn't really make any noise. It knew it was being untied, and then we let it go. And then I was sitting right there, just very depressed, very sad. The last we ever saw of it was right up there on that hill, walking towards the river.
Sean now thinks the whole thing was a bad idea. Irresponsible. The pig runs free, sure. But what if the pig is lonely, or sick, or runs into a pack of dogs? Piggles belongs on a rescue farm. And there are farms in the area that will take care of abandoned chickens, goats, turkeys, or pigs. But first you have to find it.
We even put an ad up on Craigslist looking for a pig tracker, someone who knows, you know, how to look for these animals and see if he can track it down. And so far, no one's responded.
So, Sean and his friends come back to these woods every weekend now, looking, looking.
What does a pig hoof look like? There's some footprint, there's some animal prints in here.
I think that might be a deer. I'm not sure though.
Yeah.
I didn't know what these things are.
You're listening to Lost Critters on Hearing Voices. Some years ago, a friend of mine and I paid a visit to Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Everyone knows this was one of the places where the government developed the first atom bomb. But we were interested in chaos theory. Chaos theory is an elaborate description of turbulent systems like the weather and maybe the stock market and who knows what else. Chaos theory was all the rage in Los Alamos then. And in addition to the theory, it turned out there was also real chaos in Los Alamos. It was slinking up and down the streets late at night in the form of a wild dog. We begin in a junkyard on the outskirts of town.
These are two black granite blocks. They weigh 6,400 pounds each. They were actually used as surface plates in a machine shop. You use that kind of material. You need a flat surface. The top surface of this has been ground and polished till it's flat to 150 millionths of an inch. They must have had something mounted on them. I don't know whether it was epoxied on, and when they pulled it off, there's a slight defect here in the top of the surface, and they got rid of these two huge black granite blocks. But I call them doomsday stones. I would like to engrave on the four sides in a kind of Rosetta Stone, in English on one side and Chinese perhaps, Russian. And on the fourth side, we have to engrave in the language of the little green men. And these would tell the story of what happened. It happened right here. There's the laboratory to the south of us. And after we've blown ourselves away, these stones would tell the story to the little green men about how we happened to do it and how it all came about.
We're going to go down here. First of all, we're going to walk along the north rim of the canyon, just down a trail a little ways, and look across the canyon to see if Mama Dog's laying under the tree. And like I said, with the dogs with us, Mama Dog will ignore us for the most part, as long as the dogs are with us. If the dogs weren't with us, she'd just head down the canyon and keep right on going. But I'll give you a look at her if she is over there. It's unclear to me. I know she came back in this area around 10:30 this morning. She was back in this area. So let's go ahead and walk down the trail a little bit.
When Los Alamos was set up in 1943 to design the first atomic bomb, they were looking for an isolated spot. Sure enough, they found it. We were about 7,000 feet up in Jemez Mountains on volcanic terrain, a string of narrow mesas cut by canyons, so even though we're just a mile or two from the airport in the heart of town, and even though there are houses and people's backyards all around, it still feels wild.
There have been bears and bear cubs down in this canyon.
Is that right?
Yeah. There are bobcat down in this canyon, and down in the deeper canyon, there's a mountain lion.
It's funny to think, right?
You're right in the middle of a town.
Los Alamos, right?
Yes. Population of 19,000 people, and you've got all these animals. Coyotes come down my street.
Is that right?
Yeah.
About 6 years ago, this canyon, which doesn't even have a name, became the home of a wild dog, a female who is said to be part German Shepherd. How she got here is not so clear. I heard she was owned by a nuclear physicist who committed suicide. Other people say, no, she's the daughter of a dog who was owned by another guy who owned a restaurant and committed suicide. The stories all emphasize the death of the human father. In mythology, this usually means there's going to be trouble.
There's a cave in here. It's not real big. There's about, depending on where you stand in it, 4 foot of clearance. There's some carpet on the floor and some blankets and sheets left in there that Mama Dog and a guy that grew up in Los Alamos lived in for a couple of years. I understand he befriended her, probably the only human that ever did. Big burly guy with a beard, full beard. He was killed 2 years ago in a motorcycle accident in Santa Fe.
You might think that one dog breaking the leash law would be no big deal in a town that has mountain lions, high-energy particle beams, and plutonium. But in the last few years, nothing here has stirred so much controversy, so many letters to the editor, such bitter feelings.
Charles Warner. I'm a reserve conservation officer with the Department of Game and Fish. I'm also a nuclear engineer with Los Alamos National Laboratory. No one sent me to shoot the dog. It was between the houses on Canyon Road down toward the canyon, and it was about a 25-yard shot. I have been a competitive pistol shooter and probably have two or three bushel baskets of trophies that I've won in handgun competition. I should not have had any problem with it. I know that it was just a quirk that the dog jumped just as I touched it off that caused me to, as we say, pull a 7 instead of a 10. The dog took off and went down the canyon, and the neighborhood situation was such that I was prevented from following up on the dog.
People came out.
Irate and rather hysterical, particularly Mrs. Jennings, barefooted and in her house robe and screaming at me.
I was suddenly awakened at 6 in the morning. Well, I was awake. I was lying in bed, but I was bolted out of my bed, really, by a gunshot. And I just said out loud, somebody shot Mama Dog. I just knew that was what had happened. And I grabbed my robe and I ran out to the deck, and I saw this man walking from my neighbor's driveway, putting a rifle in his coat, coming out of the driveway and walking toward my house. And I said, what are you doing? And he didn't answer me. He just started walking faster, much faster. And I said, "What? I asked you what you were doing." And I was really upset by this time. And I ran down the stairs, and he ran over to my neighbor's street, and I started by this time chasing him. And he jumped in his pickup truck and backed it all the way down my neighbor's street as fast as he could. He just floored it. And I knew then that he was trying to prevent me from seeing what his license plate said. It was infuriating.
This is ridiculous. This dog has, it's sort of wonderful to see this dog survive, and it's tough and it's intelligent, but it has done nothing to help mankind. This dog is surviving for its own purpose and is not contributing anything to the neighborhood.
Los Alamos has quiet neighborhoods with modest homes and tidy lawns. People forget to lock their doors. Driving through the town is like driving through a beloved 1950s sitcom, which you can't quite remember. Signs read Taco Bell, Golf Course, Elk Club, Free Electron Laser Laboratory, Sears Roebuck, Center for Nonlinear Studies. Here, at the Center for Nonlinear Studies, is where people contemplate chaos. Mostly they do this by feeding equations into desktop computers.
These equations say that the derivative of x, that is the rate at which x changes, is equal to 10 times y minus 10 times x. That's the first equation, all right? The next equation says that the rate of change of y, dy.
Doan Farmer, manipulating the Lorentz equations for weather. Doan says that although he has here a mathematical model for the weather, he can simulate it, he still can't make any long-term predictions. Chaotic systems don't work like that. The system as a whole is dramatically upset by the tiniest fluctuations. In the case of weather, this is called a butterfly effect. You know, a butterfly flaps its wings in China one day, stirs up the air, and then 4 months down the road, there's a storm in the Caribbean.
Minus 8/3 z. Chaos has a natural appeal because, I always thought it, in a certain way, it reconciles free will and determinism. You can have a deterministic world described by laws of physics at the same time the smallest little change can cause a very large change later on, and so you see that it could seem, and in fact, in every practical respect, you would have free will, even though things were evolving under deterministic laws, because changing things, just one little hair would cause them to eventually go off in a totally different direction. Two people meet on a train, they happen to take the same train, they happen to sit in the same seat, they start up a conversation, they fall in love, they have a child, the child's Jesus Christ, Adolf Hitler, whoever, who then totally changes the world. And who knows how things would have been different had they not happened to take a certain particular path.
One of the first things I noticed was that if I put my garbage out the day before the garbage collectors came, someone ate it. Tore into it and made a mess. And I thought at first that it was a dog that lives across the street that was allowed to be loose once in a while. But I found out that it was this mama dog, as the neighbors referred to her, who had been loose in the neighborhood for a number of years and had learned to fend for herself, eating mostly garbage. She just roamed the canyons and lived by her own wit. So my reaction to that was to begin putting dog food out beside my garbage. So I'd put the bag of garbage out and put a can of dog food in a dish beside it every night. And later on in the morning and at night when I discovered that she was pregnant. So anyway, I kept feeding her and she kept having puppies. And then, the third litter of puppies, I just kept feeding her and there just kept being all this publicity in the paper about what a terrible person I was and how I should, how she should be killed and how she was breaking the law and she shouldn't be allowed to break the law. And,
the packs are formed by, in part by the puppies that this female dog has and in part by the males that are going after her. And this female dog, as far as we could tell, never did anything against anybody. But the dogs that were moving around her would have fights just about every night in our backyard, below our bedroom window. And we had to do something about it. So we call actually the animal control, the county animal control. And they came in and put a trap in our backyard. What you'd see, for example, in one case, one of the puppies that she had was caught in the trap. And the whole pack came in and made a vigil around the thing. And, we wouldn't go out in the backyard when that was going on because there were all these dogs sitting around this trapped dog inside the trap. This was a wire trap, cage that they had. And we also saw the female dog come into the trap, eat the food, trigger the trap, hold the door of the trap with its hind legs, and then walk out the trap. It's a really smart dog.
We have had the allegation that mama dog is much like a single parent who is trying to make a living and support her family. It's a thing that known nationally as the Bambi syndrome. A lot of people watch a little too much television, Yogi Bear and Bubba and the picnic baskets and this sort of thing, and assign human characteristics to wild animals, which is a totally false assumption. So I equate this mama dog thing as to a wild animal that is peripheral to the community and has the potential for a fatal results. And she does hunt. Nightly, she is seen over behind Safeway and in the Dempster dumpsters.
At the moment there is a truce in Los Alamos, the police have agreed to back off, and Mrs. Jennings has stopped feeding the animal. Ron Ellis, a technician at the laboratory and an amateur animal tracker, has volunteered to bring the dog in for peaceful rehabilitation. So far, he hasn't had much luck.
She's been an amazing dog. She's been drugged. She's had her food drugged. The serum that the police were using in their darts, the reason why they didn't catch her, number one, they did it in the summertime, and there are a tremendous amount of hiding places down in the canyon. But the main thing was is that the serum that they were using was 15 years old. The vet told me that loaded my darts for me, told me that that particular serum had a six-month shelf life. I probably have pretty good chances if I time it right and I get a fresh snow. And I've been waiting for that for the last 2 weeks. There are a lot of hiding places down here, so I need the fresh snow in order to track her.
Unfortunately for Ron, it is hard to say when, if ever, it will snow in Los Alamos on one of the days he has off from work. Weather is chaotic, everyone says. But then, if that's the case, why would people at the laboratory waste their time studying it? Where's the payoff? Why would you bother to hunt an animal if you know you can't catch it? Well, they say, back at the Center for Nonlinear Studies, they say, prediction isn't everything. It would be nice with the weather or the stock market, but the point is, we're learning to make models of complex behavior. Sometimes, just figuring out how to make the model, the simulation, is what's important. For example, life. In a back room at the center, Chris Langton sits at a computer terminal watching a little purple blip on the screen.
Now this is a physics that I developed to try to simulate the process of self-reproduction. There's an initial configuration here which is sort of in the shape of a P on its side, and the loop you can think of as a data path, and there are signals which are sitting on this data path, and when I run the thing, you can see that these signals cycle around this loop. So it's kind of a storage ring. But the tail of the P, or the leg of the P, copies of the signals propagate down that as well. When they reach the end...
All right. It looks like a drawing of the letter P lying down on its back, taking a nap. It's not napping, though. Gradually, its tail gets longer and longer and loops around to form another letter P, which splits off and does the same thing. And eventually, there's a whole slew of these loops bunched up in a sort of triangular mass that keeps growing.
You'll end up with a colony of loops that will consist of a reproductive fringe surrounding a growing core of dead loops. This is sort of the way, for instance, a coral reef grows, or the way a tree grows in cross-section. You have the outside of the tree, the outer diameter is where the living cells are, just underneath the bark, and most of the center is actually largely dead wood. So this is about the simplest example that we have now of a system which is capable of reproducing itself.
Now, this may not seem much like the way a tree or a coral reef actually reproduces. God knows it's a pale copy of the way people do it, but it is a genuine example of self-reproduction. I asked Chris if he could, right now, take this model, this logic, and put it into a working machine. Sure, he said. You just put the information into some microchips, put the chips into, a bunch of Lego blocks with gears and motors and stuff, and then if you set the little critter down in a room full of other Lego blocks, it would run around the room making copies of itself. And then Chris gets a kind of distant look in his eyes, and then what would happen if you also modeled the logic of evolution, adaptation, pattern recognition, learning?
You can go on and on about it. Basically, we don't know what can happen. So the question is, you know, at what point are we going to be able to say, well, we've got something in this computer and it's a computational information process. It doesn't have any biological parts. It's not wet. It's not built out of the biological things that we know about, but yet it's alive, you know. We don't have a good definition of life yet. I mean, I say this as if it's just, you know, we're just going to run out and just start to create all kinds of things like Frankenstein. And it's not really a task to be undertaken lightly. I don't mean to make light of the whole thing. It's as awesome a technology, I think, as the technology that was originally developed here at Los Alamos. And it's, you know, the technology that was developed here in and of itself, you know, in the abstract sense, was the technology of nuclear fission and fusion. And what nuclear technology is best known as is the technology of death. And we're here talking about understanding the technology of life, and that is could have equally horrendous applications. Frankenstein's monster wasn't intrinsically a bad guy, but Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein, who created him, saw what he'd done and was horrified, and he denied his monster. He turned him away. He said, "Go away, get away from me. I don't want anything to do with you." And so he rejected him and sent him off. And throughout his existence, this monster was just trying to be accepted by Dr. Frankenstein. So it's you know, we're not going to be able to deny our creations. We're not going to be able to just reject them and say, "Go away."
If Chris Langton and his friends are right, there's no telling what beast might come crawling around Los Alamos. Of course, if they're wrong, their ideas will wind up on the junk heap of history, and their computers will wind up in the junkyard on the outskirts of town.
This is a big vacuum chamber. This is a stainless steel vacuum chamber, weighs over 8,000 pounds. But if you were designing something that you wanted to operate in outer space and wanted to know how it was going to operate in that environment, you could test it in a chamber like this.
N. Grothis has filled an entire abandoned supermarket with every conceivable gizmo tossed out by the laboratory over the years. This is a perfect place to look for a secondhand monopole residual gas analyzer. Trouble is, science moves fast, junk moves slow. Things are piling up here.
I've been trying to locate a third world country that might want to buy everything. There's probably $50 million worth of stuff here, and I'd be happy to sell it, you know, at 5 cents on the dollar, 10 cents on the dollar. I would love to see it used in some useful manner, some way that we might ease the burdens of the people of the world to make a better life for all of us. Los Alamos is potentially the most infamous city in the world. I went before the council at one time, the local governing body, and I suggested that in order to make the world aware of what we do here, that I said that Los Alamos, which means the poplars, should be renamed as Buchenwald II. Buchenwald was a birch forest. Buchenwald II, New Buchenwald, Buchenwald Nuevo. Of course, the suggestion wasn't very well received. People don't really like to talk about the potential consequences of what we do here. Look, I worked 20 years in the laboratory. It was just a job. You're only doing a job. People are far more concerned about a pet
mama dog is here and real and now. The fact that somebody 6 months or 6 years or 60 years from now, a million people might be killed as a consequence of what we do here, that's not very real.
You'll come over here and look straight south over here. Under that tree is Mama Dog. She's laying down watching us over there. And she will, for the most part, just ignore us. She's not even looking at us right now, but she'll look at us and kind of perk her ears up once in a while, especially if we stand here and watch her. But she will probably just stay there until we move on. Quite a dog.
Mama Chaos, the Wild Dog of Los Alamos, was produced by myself, Larry Massett, with Scott Carrier. This is Hearing Voices, on the web at hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.